طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is so important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Fahm and is continued in his memory. This is John Roberts, your host. Our presentation this morning takes a long, critical look at the media coverage of the Palestine-Israel struggle through the eyes of three seasoned journalist activists who have covered this story for years. First, you will hear from Jim Clancy, who began covering the Palestinian struggle from Beirut when the PLO was ensconced there and continues his coverage to this day. Second, you will hear from Miko Peled, who, as an Israeli general's son growing up in Jerusalem, has enormous credibility and continues to write critically about what his country is doing to the Palestinian people. Finally, you will hear from Ali Abu Nima, whose critical coverage appears in the Electronic Intifada. This panel spoke at the Jerusalem Fund and Palestine Center in Washington, D.C. last November. We begin with Jim Clancy.
Thank you very much, Dr. Ericott. You know, it's great to be here. This is my first trip to the Palestine Center, and I'm really happy to be sitting here today and talking with you. I first started covering, the question of Palestine probably in earnest a long time ago, 1982, the summer of 82 in Beirut, when Israeli jets tried to dislodge the PLO from West Beirut. And it was the beginning of years of coverage. I lived in Lebanon. I moved to Beirut eventually and lived in Lebanon, covered the Palestinians, covered their plight, and then covered it as well in Israel, going to Gaza, going to the West Bank, for months at a time. So I became very aware of what the problems were and the complexities. Although I think, and we can get into this in the question and answers, oftentimes I think the conflict is overcomplicated. You know, people like to say that, the situation is hopeless but not serious because, if nobody is being killed on any day, that's fine. And it suits the narratives of some people just to allow this to fester and continue. But I want to deal with you today talking about some of the issues here and specifically looking at some questions about the media. Certainly, there's good news and there's bad news. And let me start with the bad news, and that is that we have war crimes being committed in broad daylight right in front of our eyes in Gaza, and the media is failing to cover it and certainly failing to call it out. I mean, when we, it's horrifying to see that we've gotten to the point where one side is convinced that they can murder and maim civilians at will and suffer no consequences, have complete impunity for that. And part of the reason they have that impunity is because the media doesn't call them out. I mean, that's just the reality of the situation. If they can get away with it, they will get away with it. And unfortunately, they are getting away with it. Even when the story is covered, some of the same old things, and I've heard these complaints from people, not just, in the last few months, but literally for decades, how the Israeli side is constantly portrayed as the victims. Israel doesn't attack. It responds. Israel retaliates. It doesn't start anything because the Palestinians are the ones, the victims are the ones who are responsible for their situation. Now, admittedly, all international news right now is not getting the coverage it deserves. Gaza is just one of these huge highlights that doesn't get nearly enough attention. But this is the Trump effect, where if you turn on the 24-hour news cycle on cable news in the United States, what you discover is it's all about Trump. I mean, this is the these are the networks that put Trump in power, and they keep him there. They like the ratings. Les Moonves of CBS said during the campaign, he said, "I don't know if it's good for America, but it's damn good for CBS. Keep going, Donald Trump," because they were making billions off of the ratings and the spectacle, if you will, the reality TV show that has become a nightmare for all of us. And certainly when we look at what's happened with Jerusalem, you know, these kinds of things where we literally U.S. foreign policy is up for sale. I think the closeness of the Netanyahu government with Donald Trump is indicative of the fact that they know he can be bought. And they know they can buy him. But that's creating a dangerous alliance with so-called nationalists and these two entities, the U.S. and Israel. And it's dangerous for Jewish people. It's dangerous for Muslims. It's dangerous for everyone. Now, one of the things that we have repeatedly seen the media fail to deal with, it's, you know, this notion that Hamas has sent these people out to protest at the Gaza border. And it's not clearly, you know, there are cases certainly where Hamas is putting people into the fight and putting people at risk. But the whole notion that these people have not turned out for their human rights, their right of return, that they've turned out to be human shields for Hamas is a false narrative. But that's what the media continues to do. Now, the good news is that people aren't relying as much on the mainstream media to get their news. Social media is turning things on their head. We know that Israel has banned any video that shows the IDF in a bad light. Well, you know, that's a situation where if you're really going to do the news, you need that video. And that video has been a game changer, because it does hold people to account. It opens people's eyes when they see it. But it's accessible now on social media, on YouTube. It's being exported there. They're not waiting for the mainstream media to pick it up. In fact, many times it's the mainstream media when it gets to the point where we have a killing in Gaza that is particularly significant, like the young woman, the 21-year-old who was the medic, shot in the chest. For what? She was completely unarmed. She was more than 100 meters away from the border fence. What was the reason for that? And it brings it into focus in people's minds. And when I say social media is good news, it makes a lot of mistakes. Yes, the wrong video is there. But at the same time, it shows people the raw reality that they wouldn't otherwise be getting. It's not going through the network filters, if you will. It's not being balanced out with lies, where, you know, with two, you create a false narrative, which there's actually two sides to this, when there isn't. There's only really one side, and that is the facts of what happened. Now, into all of this comes the whole campus movement for BDS. And young people are driven by social media. They're driven for the news, but they get their news on Twitter now. They get their news on Facebook. They get their news in other places. They don't get it necessarily from the mainstream media. So that filter is disappearing. That power, to a great extent, is disappearing. Young people are the ones that need to be reached. And they are the ones, obviously, from the BDS movement, you see they are being reached by these grassroots movements. And the media has to reckon with that. And the media oftentimes now ends up covering the story in that light. Now, one of the things that we've seen in recent days is this whole Canary mission story and how it relates to the Israel project and how all of these forces are out there trying to intimidate the individuals who are standing up, being activists, expressing their opinions, literally threatening young people's careers before they ever get started. And this is something that the news media has reported, the print media at least, has reported very well. Al Jazeera has reported it very well. Some of the mainstream media have not. But these are the same kind of forces. You wonder and you ask yourself, how is it that the mainstream media doesn't really cover the situation in occupied Palestine? And I'm going to give you the inside view of that. And it's this, that when the mainstream media goes out to cover a story, say in Gaza, looking at the occupation and its impact, everybody in the office knows they're instantly going to be called on the carpet by various groups, pro-Israel groups, that are going to demand equal time, that are going to say that it was an unfair report, no matter what was in it, whether it was fair or not. They just make the situation for the media heads, the heads of those media houses, almost impossible. The networks, they say, look, it's not worth the trouble. If we get involved in this, if we start reporting, doing an in-depth series, say, on the occupation, we're going to get so much pushback on our advertisers, on ourselves. We're going to face smears. These veiled threats, they're very powerful. And I have seen one media executive after another simply say, it's not worth it. We need to be reporting less on the Middle East, not more. We don't need to be trying to explain these difficult issues. We need to just look the other way. It's easier, and it's a lot cheaper. The Israel Project, talking about cheaper, one of the reasons that they have been so powerful is that they actually literally go to the assignment desks in Jerusalem, some of the major networks, and they feed them stories that project Israel in a positive light. They don't take on necessarily the controversial issues, but it could be a medical facility, it could be aiding wounded Syrian fighters, and these are good, valid stories. But what they want to do is chew up that airtime. If there's positive news going out in the mainstream media, they don't have to worry about negative news surfacing there. Now, I know, a lot of you are going to have questions about all of this, and I'm going to try to cut it as short as possible because I know you'll have some specific things that you might want to hear about, and all of us will be, happy to answer those. I think, when it comes to Palestine, unfortunately, I can stand here before you today and say that the mainstream media is not up for any courage awards because they are just not covering the story.
All right. Well, thank you all for being here. And thank you to the Palestine Center for putting together this great event and putting me on this fantastic panel. It's a real honor and a pleasure. So somebody earlier asked me what this badge was. And so I explained this BDS stands for Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions. And these are probably the three most hated letters in Israel today. I think if they could, they would take those three letters out of every single word, of every single sign. Because they are terrified of these three letters, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions. And I think it's a testament to just how effective the movement and the movement and the call for BDS have been, and currently is, when it comes to the struggle for Palestinian rights. I gave a talk a couple of months ago in London together with Azam Tamimi, who some of you may know. He's a great scholar and a great guy. And at the end of the talk, both he and I spoke about the need to free all of Palestine and the vision of a single democracy over all of Palestine and to stay away and break away from what I think is a ridiculous notion of the two-state solution. And at the end, one of the students, this was at a university, and one of the students rose up and asked me, well, where should the Jews go? You and your one-state solution, where should the Jews go? And I asked her, well, why do you think the Jews should go anywhere? Why do the Jews need to go? And this strange mindset that there's got to be oppression one way or the other. One side always has to be pushing the other one out. There can't be a reality where people just live in peace and there's tolerance is an interesting one. But I think this, it brings to question this, first of all, who are these Jews? And what are they doing in Palestine? We know that there are about 6 million Israelis today. Now, I refer to the people, to Israeli Jews as Israelis. And I think the identity of Israelis is very, very, well, it's unique, and it's important to understand because the support or lack of support that Israelis get and the state of Israel gets here in the United States, and I'm talking about not officially from the government, but from Jewish communities, is very interesting. You saw we had two members, Rabbi Weiss and Rabbi Feldman. They had to leave because Shabbos starts soon and they have to prepare. They belong to one very decidedly anti-Zionist community that has been anti-Zionist and anti-Israel from the very beginning. Then there are communities that are completely pro-Israel and totally Zionist. And if you drive around any city, any major city in America, you see on the big synagogues the signs, "We support Israel." And then there's all these polls that show that the majority of young Jewish people in America don't really care one way or the other about Israel very much. But I think it all has to do with this identity of this thing called Israelis. And who are they and who are we? And so as an Israeli, in the subtitle of my book, The General Son, is A Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. And it forced me to think about, well, what is an Israeli and what is Palestine and what are the boundaries between these two things? Where is Israel and where is Palestine? And what does it mean as an Israeli to go into Palestine? Because I was born and raised in Palestine. But it's really a journey from the sphere of the oppressor to the sphere of the oppressed. That's really what it's about. And as an Israeli, you know, we're told that we're Jews. And that we are a nation. Well, according to the strictest Orthodox Jews and the strictest reading of Orthodox Judaism, which is what the two rabbis here would have said, Jews are a nation, but not a nation like normal nations. We're a nation that is united by our common faith. Well, Israelis are secular. Zionism is a secular movement. So in other words, if we're not, then we can't be bound by faith if we're secular. We don't have a faith if we're secular. So we're secular Jews. So what in the world does that mean? And then we're told, well, what we do here in Palestine, or as they call it, the land of Israel, is, you know, we've returned. We have a legitimacy because we used to be here and now we're back. But that doesn't really stand any kind of serious test either. I don't know any Jewish person anywhere that can trace their roots back to the ancient Hebrews. I don't think anybody like that exists. We know Palestinians in refugee camps and elsewhere have the deeds to their land and the keys to their home. I know no one Jew in the world or Jewish family in the world that can do that. So how could we claim that we were once there when we have absolutely no way to show that? We have nothing. So we're not really from there. We're not really natives. I mean, we're certainly not Palestinians, most of us. Now, when you look at Israelis today, we don't look alike. We have different customs. We come from different places. And I'll share a little anecdote with you. I remember when I was in maybe sixth or seventh grade, we heard that they were going to institute this thing called integration in our schools. And we had no idea what integration means. It's a big word, but we knew it was going to happen. And what they did was they brought the kids who were the children of the Arab Jews, of the Jews that came from Arab countries, who went to a different school than we did because they were working class people and they were lower class people. And the school was only a couple blocks away, into our school, which is the school of the, you know, the white Ashkenazi, you know, educated, wealthy, you know, we were the ones that were going to be professors and leaders and so forth, and they were going to be the janitors and the street sweepers. And they brought them to our school, not the same classes, just to the same building, and that was integration. That was integration. So, and then we looked at each other, and we had very little in common. Our parents came from different places. We ate different food. Our parents, our grandparents spoke different languages. We shared absolutely no customs whatsoever. And because we were secular, we didn't even share the same faith because we were secular. And we were more secular than they were. Typically, the Arab Jews had a little more connection to their religious traditions than we did. So we're not even the same people. So then there was the story of the persecution and the Holocaust. Because we were persecuted people because of the Holocaust, that unifies us. But Zionism really failed in providing any sort of help to Jews when they were being persecuted in Europe. And we know that from when Zionism began, the late 19th century, until the time that my grandparents, who were Zionists, ended up coming to Palestine, millions of Jews did immigrate from Europe, but they came to America mostly. So millions of Jews did go to other places, but they did not buy into Zionism. And we also know that after the Holocaust, the vast majority of Holocaust survivors chose to go elsewhere when they had a choice. The only ones that came to Israel, or what became Israel, were ones that had no choice or for some reason were Zionists, which was a minority. And then when these Holocaust survivors did come, they were treated very poorly, and they still are. Those that are alive today are treated very, very poorly by Israel. So even that, which we are told is part of our identity, really isn't. Most Israelis have nothing to do with persecution. None of us were ever persecuted. Most of us have no connection. Most Israelis have no connection to the Holocaust because very few of us have grandparents or ancestors that came and were survivors of the Holocaust. So we're not really Jewish according to strict Jewish law, because strict Jewish law rejects secularism and rejects Zionism. And according to strict Jewish law, Jews are prohibited from sovereignty in the Holy Land. And for us as Zionists, as Israelis, sovereignty in the Holy Land is everything. That's what we're about. You know, that's why Netanyahu has to jump up and down every day and say, this is ours, this is ours, this is ours, and he keeps passing laws, including the nation-state law. Palestinians don't need a nation-state law. Palestinian kids do not need a law to tell them that this is their country and Arabic is their language. Israelis do. So we're not really Jewish, and we're not really native, and we have very little in common with each other. And so what is going on here? Now, we have to admit that Zionism did succeed in forging something new. I think Israelis are a little bit like, or many ways, not a little bit, many ways we're like the whites of South Africa. We don't belong there. We're not native to the place. But now we're there. As a result of settler colonialism and racism and the ethnic cleansing and the genocide that we're on, we're now there, and there are 6 million of us or so. And we have a culture and a language and so forth. But the interesting thing is that most Israelis don't view Israel as kind of a normal democratic state. They view Israel, of its citizens, they view Israel as a state of all Jewish people, but they don't view it as a state of the native indigenous people who are the Palestinians. Even Palestinians who are citizens of the state of Israel really are not part of the state of Israel at all. And of course, we knew this all along, and there have been dozens of laws passed until now, but the nation-state law pretty much firms that up. They do not belong. So that's a strange kind of an entity. So the state does not belong to its citizens. It belongs to all these people on the outside, many of whom don't want this favor. Thank you very much. Again, if you talk to Rabbi Feldman, Rabbi Weiss, and their community, they don't want to have anything to do with that state. And like Rabbi Weiss said earlier, when the state of Israel was established, the chief rabbi of Jerusalem begged the United Nations to give them some kind of a special status. They did not want to be citizens of this thing, of this new creation. They did not want to be part of it, and they are beaten up very badly because of that. So Israeliness has to do with, really, we're not Arabs and we're not Jews. We're not Palestinians and we're not Jews. And as some kind of the younger Israeli politicians today have defined, Israeliness is defined by hatred of the Palestinians and hatred of the Orthodox Jews, because we're not either one of them, and these are two groups that actually do have legitimacy, and we do not. And so that really is what defines us. And I think it's paramount that we all come to the realization or come to terms with the fact that Zionism is incompatible with peace. It's incompatible with accepting the rights of the indigenous people of Palestine, which is why we are still 70 years later after the establishment of the State of Israel, we're still here. We're still in this situation. And so it's not so much a question of conflict between Israel and Palestine, or Israelis and Palestinians. It's a question of a movement that created this brutal, uncompromising society that is incompatible with peace. So we either accept it in whole or have to reject it in whole. And that's what I think is very difficult for many people. But, you know, and again, coming from a very Zionist family, I know how difficult this choice can be for many people. But we have to make a choice. It's either Israel or it's Palestine. And when we accept one, we reject the other. And I think the whole idea of a two-state solution is to legitimize Israel while not admitting that legitimizing Israel is incompatible with Palestinian rights. And that is this reality that is still going on today. But we have to decide, and I think the best way to decide where we stand on this, and again, I'm not talking about rejecting a people, we're talking about rejecting an ideology and a political reality. So where do Jews have to go? Jews don't have to go anywhere. Israelis don't have to go anywhere. That's not part of the conversation. But they can't be allowed to continue to be there. And when I say they, you know, I'm from them. And live in a reality where they have all the privilege at the expense of the people of the land, who are the Palestinians. And I think it's really important, and I'm going to end with this, just to clarify some of the terminology. So the big thing is it Israel or Palestine? Well, if we call it Israel, we're legitimizing this brutal, racist, apartheid ideology and regime. Because there's no part of Palestine that is not occupied. So there's no Israel and occupied Palestinian territories, because that would suggest that there are some Palestinian territories that are not occupied. So again, it's either Israel or it's Palestine. And if we accept racism and if we accept apartheid, then certainly we should accept Israel and call it Israel. If we reject them and we believe in justice and freedom and so forth and the rights of Palestinians to be free, then we cannot in good conscience call that place Israel. Because Israel is this creation. And so I would invite people to call it Palestine. And stop talking about occupied Palestinian territories, because that, again, that creates the impression that there are some Palestinian territories somewhere that are not occupied. And another interesting term is illegal settlements. So are there legal settlements somewhere? Because if they're illegal in one place, then they're probably illegal in another place. Well, what's legal about Tel Aviv, for example? You know, Israelis who live in the pre-67 borders, like in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, people like myself, you know, we're educated, we're Ashkenazi, we're white, we're good people, we're not settlers. Yeah. Are we really not settlers? What, you know, if you look at Tel Aviv, if you go to, you know, there's an organization called Zohrot, which commemorates the destroyed villages and towns of Palestine. Go to their map and show, and you can take a look at Tel Aviv and how many destroyed villages it sits on, and on and on and on. So, I mean, this is a reality. And these are terms that are very, very important. They're all illegal settlements. They're all settlements. And it all has to be, it all needs to be changed. So we either legitimize it or we delegitimize it. And I think it's a decision that we have to make now. Again, being an Israeli, I can see how that might be difficult for some people to do. And so I invite people to just look at their conscience, look at their values, and we either accept occupation, racism, oppression, ethnic cleansing, or reject it. I have a very good friend in San Diego who says, well, I oppose racism. What's your position? And if the answer is yes, but, then you know that person is not exactly willing to reject Zionism or reject racism. So I'll end with this, and thank you all very much.
Good afternoon. We have the after lunch session, so we have the hard job of keeping everyone awake. But so far, it's been very lively, so I'm going to try to continue that. First, let me thank the Palestine Center once again for having me here. It's really an honor to be back and to thank all the staff for their hard work putting this conference together. I think, you know, this is 2018, right? It's hard for me to remember sometimes. It's the 70th year we commemorated the beginning of the Nakba, because the Nakba, as we know, is ongoing. It's the year of the Great March of Return, when so many Palestinians have given their lives for us. They are giving their lives for our rights, not just for ending the siege of Gaza, but as speakers earlier in the day noted, for the right of return for all Palestinians. And it's the year that, as Josh Rubner pointed out, the Trump administration has taken so many measures aimed at really essentially destroying the status quo and liquidating the Palestinian cause, eliminating the notion of a Palestinian refugee. And their logic, as Zeina Ara pointed out, is totally flawed. Their idea that if you get rid of UNRWA, the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees, you get rid of the refugees themselves, is like saying, I know we have some doctors in the room here today, that it's like saying if you get rid of hospitals, or if you go to a hospital, it's full of sick people. So if you get rid of hospitals, you solve the problem of sickness. This is the logic. But I think we should not underestimate the power of this Trump administration strategy, because they're creating political facts on the ground. Don't expect, you know, if the Democrats come back in 2020, I think Hillary's going to run, by the way. We were having a discussion about this last night, and I'm, yeah, I just watch out. Even if the Democrats come back, they're not going to restore the consensus that existed before. What Trump creates will be the new political reality. And so I really think that we have to go on the offensive politically. We cannot afford to keep talking the same discourse about two states and international law and so on, as if nothing has changed, or as if things are going to go back to the way they were, and as if those, you know, as if that got us anywhere in the first place. We have to put into question all the fundamental questions, and as earlier speakers said, making the right of return central, as Palestinians have made it central. Remember, whatever price we are paying for speaking up about Palestine, in Gaza they're paying a much higher price. They're paying with their lives. They're paying with everything that they have. So I agree that, that Trump is providing us an opportunity to put those issues back front and center, and to stop this sterile discourse of a Palestinian state and two-state solution and peace process and all of this kind of nonsense. We also have to put the issue of Zionism back at the center, because, you know, one of the worst tricks that Zionism has played is to confuse us and many others into thinking that Zionism has something to do with Judaism. And now this is their main strategy, to claim that if you criticize Israel, if you stand up for Palestinian rights, you are somehow attacking Jews. The reality is that there is no greater threat today to the well-being and safety of Jews everywhere in the world than Israel and Zionism. And this is very real. This is not rhetoric. We saw after the horrific massacre by a white Christian nationalist Nazi in the Tree of Life synagogue in Pittsburgh that our Jewish brothers and sisters in this country cried out rightly against the racist and anti-Semitic and white supremacist incitement of Donald Trump and his movement, his ideological ilk. They cried out against it. That racism, that anti-Semitism targets Jews. It targets Muslims. It targets Mexicans, immigrants, black people, people of color. It targets us all who are not white Christians in this country. And who came out to defend these people? Ron Dermer, the Israeli ambassador, or as I call him, the ambassador from Miami, because that's where he's from. I mean, I think that illustrates the point that Miko made. The Israeli government came out full force to deflect the criticism from Donald Trump and the white racists who support him, and to put it on the Jewish left, to attack leftist Jews using the same rhetoric as the killer in Pittsburgh, that it's Jewish left-wing groups who are antagonizing Americans and bringing about this violence against Jews. And it's also also turning the using, exploiting the blood of those innocent people who are murdered in Pittsburgh to attack the Palestine Solidarity Movement and to push Congress to adopt these laws to censor and repress the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. This is Israel and its Zionist cohorts cynically exploiting the blood of the Jewish victims of a Nazi killer to advance the cause of a racist apartheid state. And it puts Jews in danger everywhere. And we see this going on in Europe as well, where neo-Nazi governments, like in Austria, are embracing Israel to get a certificate of good conduct from Israel. If you are a racist, a Nazi, an anti-Semite, but you're pro-Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu will give you a blessing, and you can go around saying, as Representative Steve King in Iowa did, well, how can I be an anti-Semite or a racist? I love the state of Israel. And this is the ploy that these people are using now. So we have to be more forthright in challenging Zionism and challenging its claim to speak for Jewish people. I think what the challenge is for us in this country is that people have laid out, other speakers have laid out the changing landscape. We have seen it in poll after poll, support for Israel slipping among progressives, among people of color, among women, among young people, and really the support for Israel consolidating on the right, as it was stated, the Republican Party is now the party of Israel. This is a great opportunity for us, but we have to seize it. And I do not see us seizing it to the extent that we can and should. There have been enough examples of the great success of good, disciplined organizing. We heard the example earlier of the bill to protect Palestinian children, the first bill in Congress supporting Palestinian rights, which now has, I believe, 31 co-sponsors. One more came on board today. But that bill didn't just happen. It happened because of well-planned grassroots work. It didn't take millions of people to do it, but it took determined people who were organized, who were doing public advocacy, who were contacting members of Congress, who were doing media work, who were holding events in communities around the country, that made that happen. And in the midterm elections, you know, not one of the members of Congress who have co-sponsored that law lost their seat. All those who sought re-election, a few of them retired, but all of those who sought re-election were re-elected. Whereas, I'm not claiming this is related, but in Illinois, Pete Roskam, the main sponsor of the Israel Anti-Boycott Act, lost his seat. So supporting Palestinian rights isn't, the killer of political careers people think it is, and supporting Israel to the hilt is no guarantee of success anymore. And this is something we've seen in the context of the Great March of Return. One thing that has been little commented upon that I noticed is that there has been a little bit of criticism from members of Congress about Israel using snipers to murder children in cold blood. Some have spoken out, sadly not too many. That's unfortunate. But I think the more significant thing is the lack of support for what Israel is doing. The fact that even fewer, I think maybe only one member of Congress, actually came out and supported what Israel was doing. And that's a sea change, because in the 2014 war against Gaza, 2012, 2008, every Israeli military attack, AIPAC will circulate a letter and get 300, 400 signatures, or the Senate will pass a resolution, you know, 99-0, endorsing whatever horrors Israel is committing as self-defense. That didn't happen this time. No letters circulated, no congressional resolutions. In other words, members of Congress, they may not have the courage to speak out, but they're not going to actually associate themselves with what Israel is doing anymore. That's a big change. When I say that we have to have a disciplined movement, I mean we have to really take seriously what we're demanding and hold people accountable for it. And I mention this because I chose not to attend the talk of the Mahmoud Abbas ambassador this morning, but I heard through the grapevine that he was unhappy with some of the things I'd said about Rashida Tlaib. First, he misrepresented them. I never brought up her support or not for a one-state solution. That was never the issue. The issue that I raised was that she accepted an endorsement from J Street, a racist Zionist organization that exists to oppose the Palestinian right of return and to liquidate the Palestinian cause under the banner of peace. Nobody contested anything I reported regarding Rashida Tlaib, and in fact, bringing this to the public was successful because it encouraged Rashida Tlaib to clarify her positions and to state them in a way she had never done before publicly. You know, people told me, oh, well, if you know her, she believes this, she believes that. Well, what she believes in private is one thing. What she says in public is another thing. And she had to state her position publicly, and J Street dropped its endorsement because it understood that Rashida Tlaib was not going to associate herself with their racist agenda. So that's what we ought to be doing, is accountability is important. Remember, Rashida Tlaib, you may love her, you may hate her, but she's not running to be your aunt or your best friend. She's running to be a member of the most brutal, powerful, genocidal legislature in the history of humanity. And we need to hold people accountable for what they say and what they do in our names. It's not enough to wear a tobe when you're sworn into Congress. There has to actually be substance to what you do. So I encourage people to hold representatives accountable. And I think that we can also look at the ongoing battle for the right to boycott and BDS. And this is a very important battle. It's a free speech battle, and it's ongoing. And there have been great victories that were mentioned, the federal judges in the Arizona and Kansas cases throwing out or severely limiting the anti-BDS laws that were passed. This is great. But remember, it's not enough to fight for the right to BDS. We actually have to be doing BDS campaigns. And frankly, at this moment in the United States, there is a dearth of campaigns. We say that we have national coalitions of to support Palestinian rights, but I don't see many campaigns going on right now. Now, this might be part of the natural cycle. There was tremendous activism on campus, a lot of divestment resolutions, and students are meeting at UCLA this week, despite a Zionist smear campaign to try to have them banned from the UCLA campus. National SJP is meeting nonetheless. By the way, the chancellor of UCLA joined the smear campaign using a typical ploy that we hear that, oh, well, you know, we good liberals have to tolerate this because we believe in free speech, even though supporting Palestinian rights is this horrible, terrible thing. Anyway, the point is students made great sacrifices and gains in passing divestment initiatives. They reached as far as they could in many of those cases. Now there has to be a next step for us. There have to be new campaigns. And I think the one I mentioned in terms of the Palestinian children's rights is a great example of how disciplined, careful, well-planned work can really yield results. I never thought that Congress could be fertile ground for Palestine organizing, but that campaign really changed my mind. And I think we need to get very serious about this. It's not just that there are opportunities for us with the status quo being smashed. There are enormous dangers if we continue to wait for others to define our cause. Why are we waiting? Why is anyone waiting for Donald Trump to come out with his peace plan? We should be coming out with our peace plan, which is the right of return, the end of Zionist colonialism, restitution, democracy, and full equal rights for everyone in Palestine from the river to the sea. Thank you.
You have been listening to a forum on the media's coverage of Israel's occupation of Palestine at the Palestine Center in Washington, D.C., featuring Jim Clancy, Miko Peled, and Ali Abu Nima. And that's all the time we have this week. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. To hear the program later that day, or to listen at any other time of the week via the archive found on the WZBC homepage, simply click on Archive and go to Sunday morning, 8 a.m., and click on Listen. However, each program is temporarily on this archive for only 2 weeks. After 2 weeks, to reach our permanent archive to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and click on This Week in Palestine Archives. It is all there due to the diligence of our colleague Stan Robinson. Thanks for listening, and we hope you'll join us again next week and every week. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts, and this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.